Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the SOM TV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. I am your host. Today is part two of our German wine podcast series. I have really one of the funniest and most knowledgeable people I could have gotten for this on the pod today. His name is Paul Greco. He is the founder of many, many things, but among them, a wine bar called Terroir in New York, which is a mainstay. If you know wine and you are anywhere near New York City, you know Terroir. He's also somebody, a pivotal person behind Summer of Riesling. He's a Riesling evangelist. And I want to get right to it. Paul, how are you, bud?
I am awesome today, Jason. Big cheers. Honor to be with you. I'm staring out the front window of Terroir in NYC, waiting for the snow to start falling. So it is awesome.
That's great. That's really great. And hopefully the wine bar is going to be filled with people again sooner than later.
Let's talk about more positive stuff. Let's look at the outlook of German Riesling, which is more positive than my wine bar's outlook right now. But anyway.
That's fair. All right. So I want to start with a couple things. First, I have actually not done a lot with you since SOM 2. We did Into the Bottle together. And in that film, you came in as one of the, this is my personal opinion as the director, one of the funniest people in the entire movie, and you came in to talk about none other than Riesling. And so what I want to do is first say thank you, but then second, find out why the hell have you devoted your life to this grape?
I come at things from a roundabout way. This world of wine, I generally do not approach with wine first and foremost in my mind. I come at it because I love music, art, history, philosophy, whatever other crap might be floating around on the front page of the newspaper or my brain that day. So Riesling specifically mirrors my love for British new wave music in the 1980s. And at least with my group of friends at that time, they wouldn't have anything to do with it. They wanted to listen to American classic rock, which I'm not saying I could not stomach. It's just that it didn't rock my world. It didn't speak to me. So in trying to get them on my music side and diving deep into these bands and the various scenes in the various cities in England, I had to fight the good fight for these bands, these musicians, these songs that eventually, let's be honest, became popular. Who would have ever thought that Depeche Mode from 79-80 with Vince Clarke on the first album, making one of the greatest albums of all time, to Depeche Mode by the late 80s playing, I don't know, that goddamn stadium out in LA with 80,000 people in it. That progression is mind-blowing to me. So let's go to wine. I grew up in the restaurant business. I'm third generation, so that was my first job and has remained my job ever since. And wine became my forte because my father sent me to Italy for 28 days after joining the family business. And I went there as a restaurateur and I came back as a wine lover. That at least I viewed my role on our family business as a wine guy. And with each passing day, I became the wine guy, and most people recognized me as such. So as I began to explore different things, I was very open-minded about the world of wine. Yes, I'm of Italian extraction, so that was my first love and maybe remains so today. But it was the entire world of it. I was very democratic in my desires and needs and wants. And as I got into it further and further, Riesling. I had no previous view of Riesling. Yes, I've drunk my fair share of Blue Nun over the years, but I did not take that to be the poster child for all Rieslings on the planet and certainly German Rieslings. It was just one of. And when I drank it, it was the perfect beverage to have on those nights. And I dug a little deeper and deeper. And as I began to talk to more and more people about this grape, these wines, this country, Germany, there was pushback, much like the pushback I got for music. And then my advocacy of that genre of music morphed over into the world of wine. And I realized more and more that no grape is saddled with the baggage of Riesling. No wine in wine area is saddled with the baggage of German Riesling. So that became the focus of my wine rallying cry. Do I really, really love it? God damn, I really, really love it because it is ultimately yummy juice. And that's why I drink any wine. I want it to be yummy. And I find those wines uber yummy. And it boggles my mind. Much like when I listened to Depeche Mode or Echo and the Bunnymen or Simple Minds back in the early 80s. How can you not love this stuff? And the same thing is about Riesling. So that is how it became my focus. And unfortunately, I still haven't got as many people. And there are, Jason, remind me, 340 million people in the United States of America. I think I might have convinced my mother and 25 other people to start drinking Riesling now. So I've got some work to do. My advocacy.
That is absolutely just not true. You have convinced a lot of people. I mean, prior to this podcast, I was talking to the producer and trying to describe you as like, you're like the Riesling lobby. You are like in Washington, D.C., standing in front of the Senate telling people they need to understand this grape. But does it come from like a, because I know there's a thing within the Somme community, within the movie community, within the anything where you have a knowledge that others don't, where you love the underdog. You want people to discover the underdog. Does Riesling, the underdog factor, is that, how much of that is the reason you want to champion it? Like if everybody drank Riesling tomorrow, are you done? Do you want to move on to Sylvaner? I mean,
yes and no. Yes, if we achieve our goal, which is world domination by Riesling, that every wine list on the planet, be they an Italian restaurant, a French restaurant, an Ethiopian restaurant, is going to have Riesling because that's how much consumers love the grape and love the wine in its fullness of expressions. And the beauty, Jason, as you well know, of our world of wine is there's always these pockets out there that you're discovering on a daily basis. Every day is a voyage of discovery. Just when you think you have memorized the 450 goddamn grapes that are indigenous to Italy, you either go on a trip there or you're at a trade tasting in New York City and you happen upon a winemaker and they pull this bottle out and you're looking at it, you don't recognize the label or the name. You say, what's the grape? And they utter some word and you're like, what the fuck is that? And then you go down this rabbit hole of, it's a grape that we've, and that is the beauty writ large of this world of wine that you have done an awesome job of documenting that we can never know all there is to know. So that voyage of education, of learning gets us out of bed every goddamn day. So back to Riesling, you are right. My advocacy right now knows no end. And if I ever get to that end and I can say my job here is done, people of America, then I might turn my attention to beer. I think beer should be a more popular beverage in this country. It's really taking a backseat to so many other things. So, you know, exactly. We'll see what happens.
All right. So let's get into the nitty gritty of Riesling. As far as, you know, it's hard not to mention Germany when you talk about Riesling. And part of the reason I wanted to do these two podcasts, I did one earlier with Sabato Segaria, is that it's not only the grape, but it's also the country that really opened up my eyes to history and personality and just the strangeness and beautifulness of wine. And Riesling is at the forefront of that for me. So talk to me about Germany and kind of a little bit of how intertwined that country is with this grape.
Well, it's the birthplace of the grape. I believe 1435 is the first time we saw a word resembling the present-day spelling of Riesling being used from the Rheingau region. And the glory of Riesling in its initial days was not what it did in the winery or the glass. It was what it did in the vineyard, that it could survive the growing season, how short it was, how cold it was, its resistance to disease and climatic pressures, that you'd plant this grape and grow it, and you would be guaranteed a crop to turn into grape juice at the end of the day. And that was a very rare thing back then. And if we look at the history of wine, the first vineyard that was a monovarietal was in Germany and was the Riesling grape and was Schloss Johannesburg in 1720. We can't say that about any other goddamn grape on the planet. We can even go to Burgundy. You can't say that those vineyards were 100% Pinot Noir or Chardonnay back at that time. Riesling was the first one because of how great it is in the vineyard, in those particular terroirs, in those wine regions of Germany. So you've got that. And then you get what happens in the glass. And yes, our palates back then were more attuned to. We valued sweeter wines more than we did dry wine at that time. And lo and behold, Riesling could craft wines with residual sugar that still had great acidity and had that very, very rare third thing, balance, holy smagolies. And we could guarantee ourselves that on an annual basis back in those days. And then, Jason, I'm going to step away from that because what's in the bottle is pretty goddamn important in the glass. But I'm not going to say there's an official competition between wine regions about which is the more dramatic sight, what's more beautiful, what's intoxicating just from an atmospheric standpoint.
I don't know. Some of these wine regions in Germany have an argument.
Well, you know, back when I was reading the wine books in the 80s and the 90s, it would invariably say that South Africa, the country, had the most beautiful wine region. Stellenbosch, all of that stuff. Been there, beautiful. But I defy you, Jason, that you and I get on the SOM TV corporate jet and we fly because you got one, goddammit. We fly to Frankfurt and then we get in our car and we drive roughly an hour and a half west. We're on the plateau and then we start coming down the hillside. We come out a tunnel. We're just to the west of Bernkastel. The Mosel River is right in front of it, just before it bends into that elongated long, that wall of vineyards, Bernkastel up to Erzig. And the longest continuous stretch of vineyards in all of Europe. I defy you when you come out of that tunnel that you're just not going to keep on driving straight into the goddamn river because you cannot focus, comprehend what is happening around you. So I'm standing there.
Well, hold on, Paul. I've got my 4-year-old daughter prepping the SOM TV private jet. It's a wagon with two cardboard wings taped to the side. We just need to make sure that it's going to hold up in the winds over Germany at the moment.
Well, perfect. Tell your daughter I am addicted to caffeine, so make sure there's a good coffee maker on that wagon of hers.
I can do that. There'll be great wine service. I can tell you that.
All right. So, are we going to do this thing? Are we taking a trip to Germany?
Take me to Germany, Paul.
So listen, whether we're talking the Mosel, the Rheingau, the Middle Rhine, the Naha, the Rheinhessen, and we go down to the faults, of course, vitally different in their own ways. And you look at these slate hillsides for anyone who has ever been to the Mosel specifically. And you go up those vineyards. One, when we talk about terroir, we are talking about a lot of different things. Yes, yes, I know. We're talking about soil, though, is one of those elements. There's no fucking soil in those vineyards. It seems like it is just solid rock, crushed slate on top with solid slate bedrock beneath it. And I'm getting down on my hands and knees trying to dig my hands into this so-called vineyard soil, and it's as if there is no fertile matter there. There's no humus. It is solid slate stone. And I am staggered that a vine can grow here. I am staggered that people would choose to work here. I'm not a skier, but I believe the green circular slope is roughly 25 degrees. The blue square is roughly 35. Black diamond is 45. I know when I stand on top of a black diamond and look down, it feels like it is straight down, vertical. Those people in some of those vineyards in the Mosel, it is 50 to 60 degree slope. Please, please, people of America, don't tell me how hard it is to grow grapes in Burgundy. That's like walking like on a flat street in New York City, for God's sakes. I'm sorry. That is easy farming. Don't tell me how hard it is to grow grapes in Bordeaux or Tuscany or Piedmont or shit like that. You've got nothing, nothing compared to what these winemakers do in many of these wine regions in Germany. So it's just the actual work involved, the manpower, the hours of labor involved to work those vineyards by hand, because there's no mechanical work, Jason, in those vineyards. It is three times the amount of hours per growing season than it is in any other wine area on the planet. And yet, when you and I go into our wine store and we go to the German section, which of course is going to be one of the smallest sections, we're going to call BS on that. And you look at the prices of those wines on the shelves, there is absolutely no correlation between the effort to make these wines, to grow these wines, and what we're paying for the finished product. Another reason why I am doing my utmost to fight the good fight to get this wine in front of more people. Jason, you and your crew are many things. You are storytellers. The pulling of a cork, that action we need to do, but we all want to be great storytellers like you. The stories that are not being told in Germany or of Germany and of German wines and of German Riesling are innumerable.
Well, I have some good news. We have a lot coming on Germany. And I also have something that is, you know, not to deviate too much from what we're talking about, but it has to do with, you know, World War I and World War II in Germany coming hopefully by the end of next year. It's a long-term passion project. But back on the wine topic, I mean, I've stood in the Mosel. I know exactly what you're talking about. I've stood in all the wine regions you've mentioned. And I do think the reason we're talking about German Riesling is that it is one of the great buys in wine. I mean, it's hard pressed to find another region that is so grossly undervalued for what the quality of wine is. Some people care about how hard it was to get. Others just don't. They just want to know, is it good? And the good news with this one is, and I think you've pointed it out, you can attack it from both angles. It's really good. And the story behind how the hell they get it is insane. I think too, you know, if you want history, there are very few places that have the history that Germany has, especially with the Romans and everything. I mean, this is why, as I was saying, you are a lobbyist. I mean, you speak so passionately. It's like a William Wallace speech from Braveheart about Riesling. what's your pillow talk like with your wife? Is this what you guys talk about, Riesling?
No, because per my earlier statement, I'm talking about anything other than wine that she begs me to start talking about wine again. So I go to sleep dreaming up all of this other stuff that I encountered during the course of my day. And then when I get up the next day, it is a mission to filter all of those things through the prism of wine. How can I talk about my new, well, I've always loved Joy Division and New Order, but I am fixating right now upon Factory Records and what those individuals did to create one of the greatest. And so I think about that topic. And
Who would have thought that you were going to go this era of British music and equate it to a German grape? This is so great.
Well, think about what those guys did when they created Factory Records with those bands and what happened to Joy Division that eventually morphed into New Order and the establishment of the Hacienda as one of the great nightclubs. On one hand, they didn't care that they didn't know anything about those businesses. And at the same time, they didn't give a damn about what anyone thought of them. They did exactly what they wanted to do. And I find a semblance there, Jason, in what we do in our joint terroir and our advocacy for the Riesling grape. What those guys did for Mancunian music, for the post-punk Joy Division that eventually morphed into the dance music that is New Order and Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark and all of that stuff, I see, that's how my brain works. Rightly or wrongly, for better or for worse, I now see wine.
I think that's great. I mean, I honestly, you know, I'm a huge advocate of the fact that when I make these films and we do anything that involves, you know, visual media and stories and films and stuff with wine, wine is always about something else. So, I mean, the fact that you're equating it to this, to me, doesn't seem that foreign. I just love the thought of it. You know, it's like, now I'm sitting here thinking, like, what Depeche Mode song represents Riesling? I mean, it's like, it's so interesting. It's kind of like, you know, Shake the Disease or something, you know, where you can't, they got to get rid of this like idea that it's only sweet. But then I have a big problem with that thought that sweet wine is bad. I really, really, really do. Some of the best wines I've ever had quite a bit of residual sugar. And a lot of those are German Rieslings, especially with a lot of age. And I always feel bad when people say, is this wine sweet? Oh, I don't want it. Or I don't like sweet wine. And most of these people, no offense to them, they don't know what they're talking about, you know, because they don't realize that the concept of sugar in wine and how it ferments and how it works. But I do think that German Riesling as a whole, it's really not fair for it to go out of fashion because of sweetness. When, I mean, how much of it is actually pretty bone dry, Paul?
Do you mind if I work my way back around to that answer?
Sure, by all means. Scott, definitely.
Okay, Jason, please. Do you believe the world, the planet is flat?
I mean, I wish a few people would fall off of it so I could be convinced, but no, I absolutely do not.
whether we acknowledge it or not, of your
I do not believe it's flat. No,
fair enough.
Not even
Thank
close.
You. I'm glad you had to felt the need to clarify that. That, you know, of your many listeners, the percentages exist, that there has to be a flat earther fan of Psalm TV.
But I want to hear from them.
Let's think about that for a second. On September 5th, 1522, the vast majority of people walked upon this planet thinking that it was flat, a round disc floating in a pool of water. Yes, there were people like Plato and Aristotle and Ptolemy who knew otherwise and said otherwise. But many, many people thought, flat, fall off the edges if I go too far. And then, Jason, what happened on September 6, 1522?
Well,
it was the completion of Magellan's circumnavigation of the globe. We obviously know he did not make it. He was killed in the Philippines. But his right-hand man, Juan Sebastian Elcano, completed the voyage. And on September 6, 1522, when he stepped off that boat onto the shores of southern Spain, every person on this planet could finally say, holy shit, it's round. So let's go into Riesling now. Is Riesling dry? Riesling is just as goddamn dry as any other grape or wine on the planet, except when it isn't. To answer your question, at least as it relates to Germany, roughly 70% of German Riesling is dry, definably dry. What do I mean by definably? Well, they're goddamn Germans. They've defined and measured everything. So less than 9 grams per liter of residual sugar. What does that mean to the listeners? And maybe not to the beverage professional listeners, because they're going to know this shit, but to the consumer, that if we can perceive sugar at 4 grams per liter and above, and I tell you there's 8 grams of residual sugar in this Riesling, you're going to say, well, that's twice the threshold I can perceive it. But I might ask that person then, well, do you only acknowledge first impressions? Do you meet someone and within 60 seconds, you've got them nailed? No, you don't. You do give them a second minute, a third minute. You go through the conversation to figure out who they are. Well, do that with a goddamn wine. And because when you do that with Riesling, German Riesling, then you get the acid coming in. And what was initially maybe off dry finishes dry. And then we can have the big B-word conversation, which is what we all need more of in our lives today, balance. So I, in my years of advocacy for Riesling, Jason, I have either overtly seized the conversation of sugar and overtly talked about it as the first thing I said to someone, or I have pushed sugar sweetness into the background and simply not acknowledged it at all. And I've let the consumer figure it out on their own. I honestly don't know what the right way forward is, other than saying to a consumer, just try it and see if you like it. And what we are trying to do in our conversations of Riesling, I have no agenda to say Riesling is the best grape on the planet and German Rieslings are the best wines. No. I just want us to return to the day. And after we finish our journey on the Somm TV private jet, we are then going to go into the Somm TV time traveling unit. And we're going to go back, as you have, I am sure, done already, to the turn of the 20th century in America. And we're going to visit all the great restaurants in this incredible country 120 years ago. And we're going to look at their goddamn wine list. And we're going to see that wines from Burgundy occupy the least amount of European selections, with Bordeaux a few more, with Champagne a few more. And what country occupied the biggest section on a wine list in an American restaurant in the year 1900, whether we're in New York,
Boston. It wouldn't
be
France, huh?
Sorry,
not France. It wouldn't be France?
It was not a wine region in France. It was German Riesling, period, amen. There was no question 120 years ago how great these wines were. And not just how food-friendly they were or value or whatever it was. And they were also the most expensive wines on the wine list. And then you could say, Jason, first 50 years of the 20th century in Germany were a little bit of a shit show. And part of that recovery, at least in our shores, was the introduction of wines like Blue Nun that were monster wines and that they were the Yellow Tails, the Kendall Jackson Reserve Chardonnay of their day, the biggest selling wine in the 60s and 70s on the planet, was Blue Nun. We all need a gateway drug. But unfortunately, what happened with that wine is that it swept the playing field of every other German wine, at least on our shores. We failed. It's our failure to acknowledge the fullness of what was happening in Germany. They were making dry wine. They were making all the different styles. We just refused en masse to recognize that and to demand those wines, and our market went into a rabbit hole without a goddamn bottle of great German Riesling. They existed. We just didn't bloody well have them. We've got some time to make up, and that's what I am trying to do.
Man, I mean, that's quite an impassioned speech. I would love, I'm assuming you've taken a look at a lot of these old wine lists, right? From turn of the century?
Well, I am not a tech dude. The one thing I have done technology-wise is go to the New York City Public Library, which has the largest collection of menus and wine lists on the planet. And you can online look at all of these lists from that time frame. So I'm just not making shit up here, Jason. There is actual factual stuff behind this statement of mine. Everything else I said today is an utter lie, by the way, but this one is the fact.
Well, but it's also, you know, it's kind of to our gain, the fact that this has gone in and out of fads. I mean, as you have, I've been to Germany and been all over, you know, a lot of the great Riesling areas, including Alsace and everything. And you can get wines there with some serious age on them, I think, because of this. Maybe I'm wrong. You know, it's a son of a bitch to get a 19 74 Burgundy. But to find a 74 Riesling of different sweetness levels in Germany or even here in the U.S., you can do it. It's not impossible. And from a wine, I think this is why Riesling was my gateway drug. And more than like just like making me want to try different wines, Riesling made me want to make more films because of the history, because of all this stuff, but because of the way it ages. And when I was in places and there'd be a wine that would be 70 years old, if it was white, generally in France or in America or anywhere else, everybody looks at you and goes, listen, it's probably not worth opening this. But if you're in Germany and you're presented with a well-stored 60-year-old bottle of Riesling, it is almost inconceivable that it's not just drinkable, but actually really good. I don't mean to editorialize, but I think that this is probably the best aging white wine that is not fortified and not incredibly sweet like a Sauternes or something like that. I kind of want, it's like a cheat sheet. And I'm kind of like, I walk the line between being afraid that everybody gets into Riesling because it's like one of my true pleasures and I don't want it to go up in price. But also, you know, it is one of the great steals if you like aged wine. How do you feel about aged versus new Riesling, Paul?
Listen, I like them all. And that doesn't just apply to Riesling. That applies to all wine because the vast majority of wine that we buy as restaurateurs, we are going to bring it in, put it on our wine list within a day, and start selling it within 2 days. So whatever we buy has to be drinkable at that moment in time, whether it has 2 years of age or 12 years of age or 22 years of age. Of course, wines with age have a certain resonance with our community, and we try and get those wines in front of people so they can tell a different part of the story of wine. Jason, I will say a prayer for you. If Riesling becomes so popular that you can't find those wines that you want at the price point that you were used to, but I think it will be more than made up for the fact that more people drinking more Riesling gives us greater access to the full breadth of all of these wines. And I'm going to dig in a little bit. And please do not, anyone listening, take this as a dig at Burgundy and the Chardonnay grape. But what was one of those major conversations in the O's, in the Somm community about white Burgundy? The premature oxidation. We were ripping our hair out, trying to figure out scientific panels, all of these things, what's going on. And to be honest, through all of this, it's like, really? Really? Here we have Riesling over here, which does not have a premox goddamn problem, can age unbelievably, and no one still is giving it the fucking time of day? Really? Such BS. But there you have it. German Riesling never suffered from that shit. But even that little problem within the professional world, we could not pull people into the Riesling world because my God, if I couldn't have my glass of Chardonnay that day, I couldn't get out of bed. It's a world of grape juice people out there. Let's explore the goddamn thing. Can you tell I've had too much coffee today? Anyway.
That's okay. No, coffee's good. It's also when you break down Chardonnay, you still look at these varieties and varietals that are, you know, not appreciated properly. You know, I mean, Chablis went through horrible waves of nobody cared about it, then everybody loved it, then nobody cared. I think this is part of the ebb and flow of wine, but it's really not fair for an entire grape to experience it. You know, a region, I understand, but an entire grape. And it's hard, Paul, to separate Germany's, I'll just say it, behavior over the last, you know, century from the perception of Riesling being attached to being German. So, I mean, you know, during World War II and post-World War II, you know, Americans, you know, we're not the kindest to the people that we have, you know, our adversaries. But it's unfortunate that the Riesling grape was probably a beneficiary of problems during, you know, 20th century. I think it's time now to move past that and move past the bullshit sweetness level conversation and all this stuff. I think now you, as the person who sells, drinks, advocates, what should people try?
Can I go back to your previous comment, Jason?
And make sure. A note? Sure. I hope you would. Yeah.
Hopefully I'll remember everything I want to say. That I think when we as wine people, if we were to write down the five most exciting wine countries on the planet, not a single person would write down Germany.
I would. Who would? Really?
Yeah.
You don't think
really.
So?
I think invariably France, of course, is going to automatically go on there. Anyway, I'm generalizing hopefully for—
No, hold on. Let's keep generalizing. What else do you think people would write? What else? If they're
in
not going to write
the
Germany,
most exciting places, I
think— This is trendy. This is a trendy conversation, you know?
You know, it depends on what part of the— are we talking about natural wine? Are we talking about grapes we don't know about? I think people, most consumers, and some fellow beverage professionals take Germany and they put it on the shelf and they say to themselves, okay, I'm going to go to Germany for my Riesling and maybe a Silvaner. And if I'm a little bit more open-minded, maybe a Müller-Thurgau. And if I'm really open-minded, of course, I'm going to go to Pinot Noir and maybe a Dornfelder and then, you know, Pinot Blanc. But most of us don't go that far. We have pigeonholed Germany for a style of wine and we put it over here. The same cool shit that's going on in France right now with natural wine, we never think about Germany in that conversation. The same thing about a new generation of winemaker coming up and doing different things. Oh, yeah, that's Italy, that's France, that's Spain, all of these new goddamn discoveries. We don't think about Germany in that conversation. And then when we step back and we go into broader views of history, we look at Germany, we feel of Germany, of being very monochromatic, very four square, hard, firm people, no emotion, all black and white. And we attribute—
Are the Germans a little to blame for this though, Paul? I'm not trying to like— I love this place. I have love the history. I love the people. This didn't come out of nowhere. I mean—
Listen, I'm just a simple wine guy, restaurant guy. I can't get into the larger conversations of why this may be the case. And yes, the Germans themselves are responsible for this partly. But we
if people say Americans are the loudest people in the city in Europe, doesn't matter what city. If there are Americans in Brescia in northern Italy, they're the loudest people. I'm guilty of it often myself. That's not— some of these stereotypes are— they're based on some type of reality. You know, I mean, when Chinese tourists go places, they act a certain way. I'm just trying to say the Germans, look, it's part of what makes it so great. It's the terroir of their personality, if you will. That Germans are German. They can't help it. They don't even— I'm referring to all Germans, and I mean this actually as a compliment, because to me, this is part of what gives the wine, the people, the place its thing. But, you know, the Germans are methodical. Their wines are not left to chance. They're not— I want you to actually speak of this. You know way more than I do about wine. But I mean, you'd have to agree at least about that, right?
Listen, I don't think wine should be left to chance per se. I get one crop a year to make a product that's going to help me feed my family. To be a farmer— oh my God, I never want to do that, Jason. As hard as the restaurant industry is right now, to be a farmer is the worst job ever, and thank God for farmers. But I guess ultimately what I'm trying to say about Germany, and regardless of who might be at fault for our present mindset about the country, its history, everything about it, Germany's history, their art, their literature, philosophy, all of these things are just as colorful as every other country on the planet Earth. And maybe what we've done, if I can try to think a little bit deeper, we take the BMW ad that talks about the ultimate precision driving machine, that there's automatons who make that shit. And then we apply that mindset to all of Germany. Massive goddamn mistake. Yes, the Germans have to be first in line to better tell their story. And maybe, just maybe, it's going to require you,
with the incredible things you're doing at Psalm TV to be a better storyteller about them than they are themselves. Because
well, I have a car. I have a wagon with cardboard wings on it. We're ready to fly here.
Let's go, goddammit. Fire up that jet.
The German thing, and this is something that I can't overemphasize. The one thing that they have besides what I would call perfect wine, and I mean this, I mean that Germany is a place where you can get wines that are so undervalued to your advantage that you can, you know, there's not a meal on the planet you cannot pair reds and whites with from Germany. Nothing. I mean, if you try to do a sushi dinner that involves some Thai food and, you know, like you said, Ethiopian earlier, if you tried to do that using only French wines, you probably could. It's going to be a hell of a lot harder. And I think the same goes for America. The same goes for Spain. The same goes for Argentina. You could probably do it, but it's real easy to pick wines from Germany to go through a meal that is, you know, focused on spice and all over the place with, you know, involves fish and involves wasabi and involves things that are really hard to, you know, drink a Brunello with. And so I think that people need to understand that this is a reservoir. And as far as the stories go, Jesus, I mean, this is why I'm still doing this. After saying I'm not going to make another film, I'm not going to do this. I've said it 100 times, and then I go to Germany and I'm proven wrong. There's more stories. There is some of the best stories in all of Europe, which are where the best stories are, in my opinion, and I think most people would agree. That's the place. Germany has it.
Yes, listen, dude, I think the Deutsches Wein Institute could use a little more Jason Wise in their life to tell their stories.
Because they're the only ones, I promise. I would love it. I mean, the idea that, first of all, you know, Germany has also been very forward thinking and embracing their history, you know, and taking responsibility, but also looking inward and thinking about what happened in the 1870s with, you know, the unification of the country and things that really interest me. Because I think history is incredible, and obviously that's what it, for you it's music and these other things, but for me it's history. And these vintages on a bottle, they signify, you know, things that have major lasting effects in our modern society. You know, Napoleon's not history. What Napoleon did in Europe and in Russia and other places still every single day has effects. Same goes for World War II, same goes for the Vietnam War. Same goes for our current president right now, which will have effects for the next 50 to 500 years. And so I look at wine as a way to put a place in a time and to consume it, be a part of it. And I think that German Riesling and German wines as a whole exemplify that like nothing else. I mean, they actually have the history to back it up. Whereas, you know, America, you know, we're so defiant, we don't have an identity in wine anywhere near Germany. So I think the fact that Germany's pigeonholed, like you said, into being a certain thing is actually to their advantage. They have a brand that they didn't even mean to create. It was created naturally over the course of 500 years. And so, I don't know. This stuff excites the shit out of me. So I appreciate the compliment. I happen to have a very good team, you know, who is better than I am at everything. So I can take credit for it. But Paul, how does somebody walk in? I don't understand Riesling. Where do they start? How do you tell somebody where on the German shelf to start? You can name a producer. You can name just a way to approach it. I'm just curious. How do you start?
You approach the threshold. You open the door. You cross the threshold. And then your curiosity shines forth. Your humility shines forth. Your willingness to go on new ventures must be front and center. And if you so do, you will look at the shelves of wine bottles in a retail shop, regardless of what country they are from, the exact same way. What's new, what's different. Don't be intimidated by the bottle shape. Don't be intimidated by the potential Gothic font on the label. Don't be intimidated by the nomenclature that you don't think you know what it means. But the beauty, if we're going to talk about a German label, is that those labels are perfect. They are the best wine labels on the planet Earth because there is not one piece of information about the wine that is not
there for you. Now, stylistically, if you are really, really focused on getting a dry wine, what is your secret decoder ring for Riesling? Alcohol level. Just look for a bottle of wine that is 12 degrees alcohol or above, and you got dry. If it's less than 11%, then know that there is going to be some residual sugar, but know that Germany is not, or Riesling from Germany is not monochromatic. There will be residual sugar. There will be kick-ass acidity. There will ultimately be balance. And most definitely, there will be kick-ass goddamn yumminess, which is why you drink this stuff at the end of the day. So the region, the grape, the producer, the ripeness level, all of those things I really don't care about ultimately. I just want you to engage. And if you're a wine drinker, I would like to think you come to the table with curiosity, with passion, for a love of a journey. And therefore, you should have no hesitation to go to that those shelves of German Riesling in your local wine store.
I love this, Paul. That's so eloquent. It's so well said. It's just really, really, really important. And this, you're talking about the reason I attach myself to sommeliers. You know, I mean, I really, the fact that your passion about this is what drives me to keep doing this stuff. Don't lose that, Paul. It's so cool. I really love this. Are you, you should give a little plug for Terroir. Are you guys doing any kind of wine pickup or sales? I mean, Paul, just to the audience that's still listening, you have to understand this guy, he is not just entertaining, he knows his shit. And are you selling wine? What are you doing right now?
We're most definitely, the front doors are not open. We are doing, we're living our best virtual lives right now. I'm trying to live a life online to do classes, which we offer to do private classes. Of course, we're thrilled about that. To teach, to talk, to share our passion and curiosity about wine in, to be honest, another format, which I really didn't know existed before March 16th. In addition, if one wants to talk about purchasing a bottle of wine, send me a goddamn email and I would love to talk shop. I'm sitting here, I'm staring out my front window. No one's opening up the door to come and talk to me. I just want to see people, goddammit. So bang on the window and I'll come and we'll have a goddamn conversation.
Well, if you're daring, give your email right now.
Yeah, I will be fully caffeinated when I see you in person or when I respond to your email. So God knows what will happen. But we will converse, which is what this world of ours, Jason, is all about, that you and your team are promoting too. It is the conversation of hospitality that we just want to engage in and we miss absolutely right now and are trying to figure out new ways to do it.
Love it. If you want to buy a bottle of wine or interact with Mr. Greco for a class, I recommend you do it very strongly. Paul, how can they get a hold of you?
P. Greco, G-R-I-E-C-O, at wineisterroir.com. I'm sitting here and I'm waiting to hear from you.
Love it. Love it. Well, Paul, it's always a pleasure. I can't wait to get you in the next long form project that I do. And there's no question when we do this whole thing about Germany and the history of Europe, you will be involved. So thank you so much.
Jason, my pleasure. Tell your daughter that on that plane of hers, I like a seat at the back of the plane. I want cramped leg room. And as long as the coffee maker is on for the entirety of the plane ride, I'll be there, dude.
I can't wait for this flight. She's a terrible pilot. All right, my friend. Be safe.
You got it. Stay healthy.
Right, bye.
Ciao, ciao.
Thanks for tuning into the Somm TV podcast. Do not forget, we still have subscriptions available. If you forgot to get a holiday gift for anybody, a Christmas gift, Hanukkah gifts, $49.99 for the year for Somm TV. And those of you who were gifted, and man, am I happy to see how many people bought Somm TV and are going to be watching it for the next year. Do not forget to claim the gift, because you have to actually go there, claim it, so that you can start watching it on your favorite device. Anyway, I wish you all a very, very, very wonderful and prosperous start to 2021, and I can't wait to see you in person again. I miss all of your faces. Okay, be safe.